right, let's do it. Welcome, everybody, to the Dreams Don't Have Deadlines podcast, where a dream is what you make it, but you'll never make it.
Without a dream.
That's right. I got my man Marwan.
What up?
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing amazing.
Okay, okay. We got the dream team in the back. What's up, everybody? Chilling out on a Sunday. It feels good, man. We are a movement in motivation, everybody. We are the pinnacle of perseverance over here. You know what I'm saying? And we only have one goal and one mission right here. You know what that is?
Dreams don't have deadlines.
That's right, man. That's right. We want to make your dreams a reality. That's what we do. That's what we're here. Because dreams can go up, they can go down, but they do not have deadlines. You feel me? So, Marwan, how you feeling today, man? Let's talk about our new guest, because we got a very special person in the house tonight.
We got a very amazing guest.
Yes.
The one and only Alien You. Let's give it up. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful Sunday in Toronto. I mean, as beautiful as it gets in the wintertime.
Yes.
So, you know, we're enjoying it. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me on.
No, thank you for
We got questions.
I know you got questions.
We got questions.
I'm ready.
So you, we're excited about this episode because we have a lot of questions about Web3, about crypto world, everything around it. It's been booming the past couple of years.
For sure.
But like, I don't know about Juice, but I'm still confused till this day on what that world even means and what it means to us in the music world. So, you know, we understand that you have you're a CEO of your company, My Muse, and you're focusing on helping artists really enter the Web3 space and how they can kind of take ownership over their music and their rights, and really make as, you know, much revenue as they can off of their art. So like, you know, how did you get into that space, first of all?
Oh, I'm going to go back in time. I got into it in 2016. My co-founder now started a project called Smart Refer. And at the time, it was a company that allowed for people to refer their friends on the blockchain to be able to apply for jobs and to be able to essentially get paid for referrals for their friends to these jobs. At the time, obviously, this was blockchain in 2016, and this was way ahead of its time, and selling people on using the blockchain was super hard. So that project actually didn't go anywhere, but that was my first leap into Web3 as it stands now.
So you had the vision early that NFTs and this whole, in the whole Web3 space would be the future of what's going on. You saw that early? Did somebody put you onto that? Like,
No, I'm very curious by nature. I think we all need to learn a lot. Just, we all need to realize that we're students. We never know everything. And just doing a lot of research myself at the time, I think it would be best if I kind of say what the difference is between Web 2 and Web 3.
That would be great.
To kind of understand it better. Web 2 was essentially centered around reading and writing on the internet, right? So this is where content creation became the forward thinking that a lot of the tech companies jumped on, because they were like, we can give you a platform and give you the audience, but you will be the creators for us. So the user generated content kind of took over. If we look at Facebook, if we look at TikTok, if we look at Instagram, it's all user generated content. So they just had to create a place for all of us to coexist together and nest that community. But all the creators would be coming on and actually doing the work for them that they will be able to monetize. So obviously with that, as creators, we never got a part of that pie, of the revenue pie, because the idea was, we give you the platform, but we'll monetize it. We'll sell your data. We will monetize the ad clicks. We will get the revenue. And I mean, Web2 as it stands now, they've gone further and they understand that that can't happen forever. And they've now started monetizing creators with TikTok, giving you like a little bit of earnings here and there, with Facebook allowing you to sell certain content, but it's still not on par. And that's what Web3 is trying to solve. Web3 is read, write, and own. So instead of having intermediaries, you actually own your content and you're the one that makes the money for owning that content. So kind of having the foresight before, when I was looking at it, knowing that this creator industry can't last forever. There's going to be a point where creators are going to be like, we're creating 90% of the content, but we're not getting paid 90% of the revenue.
You see it now. People are taking over their own careers into their own hands, right? Like, we're tired of mans like, you know, the Sam Cooks and the James Browns, and even up to the Michael Jacksons getting raped for, you know, work that they've put in. But sorry, continue.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. And so looking at that at the time, I was like, this is not going to work. So if Web3 is the next big thing, how can we adapt and move into it and be the pioneers of that space and kind of pave the way for everybody else and show them that what is actually possible? Obviously, myself coming from a tech background, but also coming from the creative background as well, I saw both sides of the coin. At the time, like, I was a traveling photographer myself for 4 years, and I created a brand called Pay My Invoice. And the whole idea behind that was pay my invoice. Like, we're tired of not getting paid. Yeah. We're tired of the fact that, like, I have to chase people for money that I've earned. Mm. And that was a kind of like the first part of the movement before I really jumped into it.
So just to jump in here, just making sure, like, you started as a creative, right? And then correct. Seeing the hardships of trying to make a career out of what it is that you love to do and the work that you create.
Exactly. And also, because I have a media and branding and marketing agency called Mer Media, with myself and Four Corners, we've worked with a lot of artists. Like, right. I've been as much as of a creative as I've been on the side of artist development, as I've been on the side of helping small businesses go from mom and pop shops to going online. Mm-hmm. But on the creative side, it was more so just seeing how the industry was moving and just seeing how much of the content, like I said, was created by us and how little of the revenue pie that we were getting. So when I, going back into the tech world with a company called Liquid Marketplace, I've learned a lot of the ins and outs and really build the tech stack for the company, really build the prototype. And in actually being a part of that process and learning as I go. And again, a lot of people think that being a part of the tech industry is so, like, you have to be an expert. What most people don't realize, this industry is the youngest industry ever. Damn. It's less than 10 years old. So nobody is an expert.
Wow.
And that's what I like about Web3. There is that communal abundance. Like, we all don't know what we're doing, but let's figure it out together.
Yeah, I love that.
It's kind of scary, though, if you think about it. And that's kind of what scares me as just an outsider looking in, when I don't understand what Web3, but there's a lot of hype and news around it. And individuals like yourself and entrepreneurs like yourself are like, hey, look at the opportunity within this space. When you entered it and learning these things as they go, did you feel like it was a scary thing entering the space and not knowing, or were you excited about not knowing?
I feel like being a pioneer of any industry is both exciting and scary because you can pave the way for people, but you can also lead them to not such great areas.
Yeah. I've seen that before too. Yeah.
Right. Like, you kind of have to take accountability and responsibility for that and do it to the best of your ability and be able to really research and only speak on things that you can speak on. Okay. That's what I'm big on. It's like, don't lead people to the water if you don't know where the water is, mm-hmm. right? So to me, it was more like, yes, it's scary 100%, but I also know that I come with integrity and I come with knowledge that I wouldn't talk about unless I was 100% certain.
Got it.
And that's the most we can do, right? Like, that's, the industry will change. Like, if we look at the boom of social media, when we all jumped onto Facebook or Instagram, nobody really knew what we were doing. We didn't know that they're going to have the ownership of all our content, but we still did it.
Yeah.
So the I think the thing to focus on here is the industry will change and it will mature over time. It's just a matter of who do you trust and doing your own research and doing your due diligence on the people that you're kind of, you know, cheerleading in this new space.
It just makes me think of, remember the times when we used to write on people's walls on Facebook? That was a thing, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was, man.
How about the poking? Yeah.
The poking? Yeah, oh, my God, the poke. The poke. And someone being like, yo, I poked you earlier. It's like, what did you do, man?
And then people getting bent like, you never got, like, yo, bro, poke me back. That's when I was done with Facebook, yo. Like,
that sounds like an X-rated website right there. But just to go back to Web3 and Web2, so... it's a dumb question, but
no dumb questions ever.
Are they both based on blockchain technology?
No, Web 2 is the internet as we see it.
Internet as we see it.
So it's typical internet. It's
okay. That's like me going on Google Chrome and stuff like that. And then Web 3 was based on blockchain technology.
Web3 is decentralized. So what that means is that no one particular person owns it, and it is hosted on blockchain. Yes,
got
correct.
It. Okay. Because for me, just trying to understand this blockchain system, I've been trying to read up on it, and it's like it's a system, a ledger system that everybody can track everything that's happening, but it's owned by a community. Is there like a regulation behind it? Like, and the reason why I ask that is like, okay, me going outside and spending regular currency money. You know, I know it's backed by the Bank of Canada and the government of Canada. So there's some type of safety net, even though, you know, I'm not going to say everybody should trust the government, but there's some type of safety net in there, right? But then going into the Web3 space and crypto space, I'm just like, what's backing this up? How do I know this value is real? Like in Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these little cryptocurrencies that are happening.
I mean, we can talk about that for a very long time because that's a whole topic by itself. Okay. But you don't know because a lot of it is supply and demand driven. And mm-hmm. a lot of these coins do have utility that are backed by real things. But it's just doing your own research. Because this industry is so new, you will definitely not have the backing of the government. And I know there's a lot of conversation right now with the different regulatory bodies about like, how do we make it more legitimate and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also think that brings a whole different problem into, you know, decentralized world. The whole idea was that it's not controlled by anybody, that everybody's for themselves and you kind of do your own research and you're knowledgeable about why you're putting your money into something and believing in it. Bringing the government into it again makes it centralized. And I think those two don't coexist quite well. We've seen the examples of that with FTX, where we try to bring centralized into DeFi, into decentralized finance. And again, that's what causes problems.
That's actually one of my questions. So it's about FTX because everybody watching this, they've heard the past few years someone telling them, yo, you need to get into the crypto market, yo, you need to invest in this currency and whatever. And then looking at companies like FTX and looking at, you know, fraudulent examples like that where they take people's money, they do whatever, and it's unregulated or it's mismanaged. Mm. It kind of puts a scare in me as a future investor, being like, whoa, there's so many things happening here. How do I know what to trust to invest into this world that's supposed to be the future?
So I think there's a few things there. With FTX specifically, or any really platform where you can trade, what the appeal is the fact that most people don't understand how to do it without the intermediaries that look more like Web2, where you can come in, where you can purchase it with a credit card, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to speak against all the different platforms because not everybody is like FTX.
For sure.
And there is bad players, like I said, on every level in every industry, but especially in this one because of the fact that it's so new and people kind of trust the fact that it's a corporation and, you know, I could put my money in it the same way I could do it with the banks. Mm. I think one important thing to remember is whatever you purchase your crypto with, just don't keep it on the website. Like, put it in your cold wallet. Take it off, and that way, even if that site goes crashing down, you still have your funds in your own wallet. And I think that's the part of education that nobody speaks on. Okay. It's like a lot of people are convinced that if I buy it on this website, that's where it sits. And it's not like that. You own those coins. You can actually take it off the website and send it to yourself, to a Ledger wallet, to any, there's many different types of wallets. I'm not gonna
advertise on here. And you can cash it out?
You can cash it out and put it into your own wallet. And that way, let's say when FTX got crashing down, not everybody got screwed over.
Right.
People that had their funds out, that transferred it out right away, they're fine. They still have their funds. It's just a matter of keeping it in there is the problem.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, a lot of people just don't speak on that. They don't educate people well. But also it's reading the terms and conditions of the websites that you're trusting.
Yeah, that's true. Who does
I know
that
we
these
all
days?
Kind of click accept
yeah,
all.
Yeah, we all do.
But when it comes to your money, treat it as an investment. Mm. So if you're looking to buy and invest on a, you know, Web2 type of platform, then make sure that you really look over the different stipulations that they're saying in their terms and conditions, the privacy policies, and kind of go from there and really judge it for yourself. Like I said, this space, because it's so new, everybody is for themselves. Mm. Essentially, it's like gambling. I'm not going to lie. Because end of the day, you're trusting something that you've researched on your own. But at least it's, if you research it properly, it's you're doing it with knowledge. It's not just, it's educated gambling. Yeah.
Take it seriously.
Take it very seriously.
And for artists, like you were saying, it makes a world of a difference by you saying it's another tool in your toolbox to owning your art and your content and having more control over how you can sell it. Like, is that the conception of My Muse, is giving that power to the artists?
With Muse, the reason that it really started is because being around the artists for the last, I don't know how long, I want to say like at least 15 years.
Yeah.
I've really seen the struggle from all sides. Mm-hmm. I've seen it from the management side, because there's never money for managers at the beginning. I've seen it from the side of trying to have a team that just believes in you, but also it's unpaid. And I've seen the artists from the struggle from the artists, where it's, you've put in so much money into creating something. You've put in so much work, so much time, so much love. And end of the day, you're sitting there waiting for your royalty streams to trickle in, and
talking about our musical careers here.
And I admire the resilience of a lot of artists that, you know, continue to do that. So with Muse, my idea was to really marry the tech and the music industry in a sense that would benefit both sides, both with tech kind of having a place where art lives in Web3, but with music, it's giving power back to the artists. So what that really means to me is, let's change the narrative that you're not making 90% of your revenue. Let's really make it that you make the 90%, and yeah, sure, 10% goes to fees and, you know, services and so on and so forth, but you get that 90%. So with Muse, what we're aiming to do is allow artists to first nest their communities and build their like fan bases, which I think a lot of people don't focus on. Sure. A lot of the audiences are linear. So I'm an artist, I speak to my audience and I connect with my fans, but it's a one-to-one, right? Mm. The idea with Muse is, why not let your fans to communicate also? Because there's no better promoters for your brand than people who already believe in you. Okay. So with Muse, we're allowing you to nest your communities, to have them in private chat rooms, and people that really are your fans can actually speak you, like big you up in your rooms. They can bring their friends in the rooms. We're gonna allow artists to drop both released and unreleased music onto the platform via NFT technology. And we're gonna allow actually for co-ownership shares. So what that really means, and I'm gonna like touch on it lightly, I don't wanna talk too much about Muse.
Break it down.
If let's say you have already released a project that's been on DSPs, being digital streaming platforms, you're able to now give up some of the streaming royalties and sell it to your fans. So let's say if I'm a fan and I really like your project, I will buy the shares of that project from you, and I as a fan will wait for the trickling of the royalties in perpetuity. But you as an artist will get the capital to work on many other projects. Yeah. What we believe is, you don't need 1,000, millions, whatever fans. Yeah. You just need 100 people that really believe in you. Right. And that's going to make all the difference in your career. And getting that capital up front with artists, we all know, like, again, I'm a different kind of artist, but with music artists, you always have the ability to create. Mm-hmm. There's never going to be one song. You're going to have thousands of songs over the period of your career. And if you're willing to give up that part of the ownership so your fans can actually feel the sense of ownership into your brand and actually feel the sense of ownership into your work, you'll get the capital up front and you'll create that many more projects. But
I'm a big fan of LaRussell, and he's a big proprietor of doing stuff like that and making I believe that a long time ago, the line between fan and artist is like, it's not here and here anymore. It's not big and small. It's very linear, like you said, you know? So we, as artists, should be partners with our fans. And if there's a way to do that where we can cut out, you know, the bureaucracy of the labels and all of that stuff, and we can just, me as an artist and you as a fan, can work together and build something that we love, I think that's, in its essence, the best part of why we do what we do. You know?
And I think it's part of it too, is giving the power back to the people. It's right. Like, we don't want labels to come to you and be like, well, you don't have fans, we can get you fans. No, you have fans. They just, you now need to utilize your quote unquote army to make sure that they're promoting your brand just as much as you are.
So let me ask you something then. If you had an artist that came to you with all the criteria that you needed to market that artist, give me a breakdown of some kind of plan you would do to get them started.
Are we talking on Muse or in general?
Ooh.
Start with Muse.
Let's start with Muse. Okay. Yeah.
Start with Muse.
With Muse, what we're doing currently is we're actually curating artists for the platform, specifically independent artists in the hip hop and R&B genre. The criteria, really, there isn't a criteria. I hate when people ask that question. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's just because I feel like that puts people in boxes. Mm-hmm. I think the best way is to, if there's talents, the idea is how do we make it, how do we make your dream into reality?
Right.
Okay. And what is the best way to do that? With Muse, what we aim to do is a couple of things, but we're also launching live events in the main cities in Canada. Mm-hmm. And kind of hoping to provide the infrastructure for artists to perform, but also to put the power between cross-pollination of users.
Okay.
So what that means is, let's say if you're coming to Muse as an artist that maybe doesn't have as many fans, mm-hmm. we're looking to put you onto like the main stage on Muse, so then you're seen. And the idea there is, because we're launching with a specific genre, is we all consume music. And especially in the same genre, it's not a far-fetched thought to be like, well, if I'm a fan of Rochester, I can be also a fan of Russ. I can also be a fan of Drake or whatever the case is. The idea there is to just put you in front of those eyes and put you into a room of people that already like the genre, that already like the idea of independency and supporting independent artists. And I think it's a no-brainer from that point on.
I like it. I like it.
How does that differ from an artist just going to you for general advice, seeing the landscape today?
I'm only one person. Mm. I think the idea here is to utilize not just the power of marketing, but it's also the power of your fans.
Got
it. It's the ability to say, you know what? There's 10 people that believe in me right now. Let's put them into a room and build a community and give back to that community, nourish it, and see that, you know what? Maybe as an artist, I need a graphic designer. The idea here is, now I have a community of people that I can ask, and I guarantee you there's going to be somebody that knows somebody, or they are a graphic designer.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to work with them, and they get to work with their favorite artist.
Got it.
So it's, Muse is more about building communities for artists, and as well as providing communities that they can kind of dip into just by being a dope person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People,
yeah.
Just having that access to your fans, but also having the fans to have direct access to you.
Yes.
And that's what we're all about there. That's
so amazing. How much, I liked how you put it, nourishment would you give to a fan out there who's a fan of an artist? How much do you think, with social media right now, right? There's a lot going on. There's a lot of different ways to feed your audience. How much do you think it would take for an artist to really build a connection with one of their fans?
I mean, there's no real timeline and there's no deadlines, I guess. But I think the best way, and again, it's a very thin line between obviously fans abusing your time that could be used differently.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just the idea of taking them on a journey with you. Mm-hmm. I think that personally, I'm a music lover first.
Right.
And a lot of the people that I'm a huge fan of has taken me on that journey. I've seen them really evolute from, you know, doing things in their basement to now selling out stadiums. And I find that a lot of artists don't want to get to releasing a lot of stuff before they get to a certain level. Like, this is the level that I have to be on.
Right.
But what most artists also don't understand is you have to get your whack out, and you have to get that, like, let's just get this out. Maybe it's not good to you, but it will inspire others. And that will be a part of the journey of the long process that all your fans really see. Mm. They're going to be like, you know what? I remember when, let's say, Rochester, I'm going to use you again.
Go ahead.
Back in the day when it was like this, and now going to this level and being that star level, and they can be like, but I was a part of that journey. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really is missing, and a lot of artists don't show that process, and is super important.
No, that's very true.
I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about you and your life. I want to talk about, like, you know, you moved around a lot as a kid, as I understand it, all over Central Asia and Europe. And tracing back to your alias name, Alien You, I wanted to ask, is that name there because you felt like an outsider all your life?
So I came to Canada 18 years ago by means, like you said, of a lot of different countries. My mom at the time was a single mom of two, and she really moved around for work. Like, she would get sent to audit huge corporations, and because my parents were divorced, we would kind of come with her on these trips and stay over time.
She was an executive, right?
She was an executive. She's my biggest role model.
CFO, right?
You CFO, said? Yes, so correct.
She, all right, Mama Alien.
Hey.
Kicking ass.
And I've learned a lot of the resilience from her, because although I'm doing a lot right now, like, I don't have two kids to have to also think about while I'm doing it. So we really forget how much our parents really have to go through to get where they are now.
100%.
And also just, like I said, the resilience of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we moved around a lot. And I've lived in various places. I've lived in Turkey, I've lived in Bulgaria, I've lived in Germany.
Wow.
I've actually lived in Kazakhstan, and I think that's always really
that's
funny.
Awesome. That's awesome.
And then by means of that, I came to Canada.
Where were you born?
I was born in Bulgaria.
In Bulgaria, okay. Yeah.
And I can't.
Hold on. That's a lot of life to live. And when you talk travel, I know Marlon's big on travel. And I believe, you know, there's a lot of knowledge in travel. You know, it's a great way to learn and experience new things. So I just need to know, like, what was living in a lot of these places like and the experiences? You don't have to go too deep. Just like, how did it make you feel?
Well, first of all, moving around like that as a kid, you're alienated a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of going back to your question, because I know I kind of took a very roundabout way of bringing it back. But because I've moved around a lot of the countries that I've lived in, every single time I would like go to school or anything like that, it would be learning a new language and not being able to communicate. And then getting to have friends and then not having friends because you'd have to move again.
Starting over.
Yeah. And you learn a lot from that, because it's the idea of lack of attachments. And I know it's a Buddhist idea. I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate that I had to learn that so early on, but it's the ability to let go and just know that things are temporary, and not in a bad, negative way how most people think of it as. It's just, you kind of come in, you do your part, you learn a lot, and you move on. So it was definitely hard, because just learning different languages, just not being able to stay in one place, was, at the time when I was a kid, I didn't really understand it. Obviously, now looking at it, it was a blessing in disguise, because I've got to see so much, and I've got to learn so much, and I've got to experience so many different cultures and understand that.
It really feels like you use it like a strength, you know?
But when I was a kid, I was...
Not so much.
It's tough.
Not so much. It's funny how life works like that sometimes, right?
Well, perspective, right?
Right.
You really have to learn how to look at things sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to realize that every negative experience is in a way a positive experience, because no matter what the failure is, you learn from it. And that knowledge is nothing you can learn in textbooks. That knowledge is, you felt it, you had to go through it. And there's no better way of learning, in my opinion, other than failure.
And how many languages did you know by the time you came to Canada?
Four
languages.
Wow.
What do they speak in Bulgaria?
Bulgarian.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I spoke Russian. I still do. And then English and French.
Wow.
And is your mother Bulgarian as well?
My mother is Bulgarian and German. My dad is Turkish and Armenian.
Okay. That's a cool combo.
Yeah.
It's very interesting on both sides. Both sides have a lot of beef, but you know.
Yeah, for sure.
What was it like coming to Canada and like your first kind of experiences over here?
When I first came to Canada, I didn't speak English quite well.
Mm-hmm.
So overcoming that was a big part of my journey.
Mm.
And I was lucky enough to have a mentor growing up. I was actually in event planning, in nightlife, and I've done a lot of different things in terms of putting events together. We actually were the first people to bring Tiësto here.
Crazy.
I was part of organizing.
Just dropping that. Just dropping that.
Light flex.
Casually.
I don't know.
What year is this?
Wow.
2006, I believe.
So this is like height of Tiësto times.
Well, I think it's important to mention that when I was doing event planning, I was 13 years old.
That might be a little bit important to mention.
How's that possible?
At the time, I don't know if you guys remember, there was all ages events happening.
Yeah.
I started as like
I remember. I'm the grandpa here, so
I don't want to age myself. So I started like as originally under my mentor doing all ages events. I actually ended up co-owning that company 8 years later. But in that, because I was around it at such a young age, I've learned a lot. And by the time I was, I believe, 16, I was managing a team of 40 young promoters. we were bringing about 2,500 people to the government at the time.
Wow.
And my team was one of the strongest teams in Toronto for, again, all ages at the time, because I wasn't of age yet.
Right.
But kind of having that experience and having to operate and manage that many people at such a young age, that definitely brought in.
How does a teenager do that, though? How does a teenager rent out the government and bring 2,500 people?
Well, no, no.
How does a teenager deal with promoters? Like, you know, like, I mean, owners of businesses and stuff like that.
Well, I wasn't, to be fair, like I said, I had a mentor and he owned the company at the time, but I was the integral. I was doing operations at the time at the age of 16.
Wow.
So.
But you're in the business. Yeah. You're still learning.
That's crazy.
Figuring it out.
And so you did that for how long?
I did that for about 10 years.
10 years.
Roughly. Mm-hmm. I left the industry probably when I was about 20, 21 years old, just because many people think that being in nightlife or event planning is you get to party for a living, but nobody sees how much you see on the negative sides, how much you see, you know, you learn a lot from people's behaviors.
You're usually the last person to party too, because you're worrying about your own event, right?
I was going to say, nobody really understands that. Yeah. So it was a lot. Yeah. I had a lot of gray hairs. But
Stress. Yeah, I can only believe.
And how was your family dynamic moving here in terms of, like, you moved here with your mom and your sibling, you said?
Yeah, I have a sister.
Yeah, and your sister.
So when we moved here, and again, my mom wasn't a fan of me being in nightlife at such a young age. Yeah, I can imagine.
Did she come here for work? Is that why you guys moved here?
Yeah, she had an opportunity in Canada. And when we moved here, my sister was just getting to an age where she's about to actually start school. And the idea was that we stop moving around. I was like the tester child. My mom tested it. Like, yeah, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So by the time we moved here, I got into nightlife. And that was a hard conversation to have with your parents at 13, because obviously... Yeah. Everybody is like, no.
You
should be doing 13-year-old things.
Yeah, but at the time I was like, no, like, I want to be doing this. And I've explained, I'm like, it's not, my mom, obviously being European, to her, nightclubs or alcohol, crazy things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So having to explain that, no, we're doing these events without alcohol. We're just trying to make sure that kids have the taste of being able to see artists and really showcasing what is it like to have a proper experience for people to see artists on a level where it's like, it's not in, you know, and also to give them a space to not party in somebody's basement unattended. Like, these were events that we were putting on where I did have to, at the age of 16, to speak to parents and explain that, you know what, this is actually safer for your kid because it's supervised. There's no alcohol, nothing on premises that can hurt them. We're supervising it. We would run buses from different areas to make sure the logistics are there. And to really explain that to other parents, well, and like, I didn't look like I was 16. So they thought I was this grown up. Bro. And in my head, I was like, no, I am so young. I'm pretty much the same age as the kid that's coming here, but I'm just put in charge.
Carry yourself differently, yeah.
Had to.
Also.
But yeah, so growing up with that, with my mom was hard, and we had a very hard relationship because of that.
Because of that, yeah.
But I also think that low-key, she was proud of me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, did you, I guess because you had that entrepreneurial spirit since you were a young kid, and then you always had a dream of owning your own company and doing these type of ventures?
Honestly, yes. And I'll speak on that from the perspective of everyone kind of glamorizes entrepreneurship. So... Everybody says, you know, you got to be an entrepreneur. You get to, like, make your own hours, and it's cool, and you get to do whatever. But nobody talks about how hard it actually is. Yeah. And nobody talks about that by the time you finish work, you actually have no hours to make.
Yeah.
So was it my dream? Not really. But I also realized that, and this is kind of like a little Easter egg, you guys will see it soon, that I was unemployable, because a lot of the time that I would come in and be hired by businesses, I'd automatically see a lot of downfalls of the business, and then I'd be considered a threat and not be able to move up on the chain, because they would be like, no, absolutely not.
They don't like change.
What do you mean when you say you saw downfalls in the business?
Like, I remember working at the dollar store, and I remember how much money was wasted on items, and it could be solved right away. Like, I was working there, the dollar store, how old was I? Probably like right before I got into nightlife, actually.
Right.
And I got that job only because of a connection of a friend. It was like her uncle at the time that owned it. I think I was 12 years old. So I wasn't even supposed to work, but they like hired me low key. Not gonna mention.
Started pointing out everything that was wrong with their company, and they're like, "Yeah, we got to get her out of here."
Yeah, they were like, they didn't like that at all. So they were just like, "No."
Threatened.
And that was like a smallest part. Like obviously going into industries, like I've worked in wealth management at BMO for a year. And I was the youngest in that office at the time. I was about 20 years old. And I had this like fire red hair and everybody there was like 40 plus. And again, not bringing age into this, but I wasn't well received. They actually wouldn't even allow me to manage certain portfolios based on my appearance.
Got it.
And I didn't like that because if I had the knowledge, why wouldn't you not allow me in those rooms?
Yeah, yeah. Really just profiling you at that.
Unfortunately, and it was a male dominated office. There was barely any women, and all the women that were hired were just assistants. Nobody in the positions of power.
Got it. And I wanted to ask in terms of like, when you got done with promotions at 21, did you go to school? Were you in college?
I'm a college dropout. I did go to school. I went to George Brown for about a year and a half, but being in that program, and this is no diss to education, and I'm not going to sit here and advocate for not educating yourself.
Shout out George Brown.
But the idea was I was learning essentially terms for things I've already done hands-on.
Okay.
And to me, it was a waste of time and it was also a waste of money because to me, it was sitting in a room and learning things that I've been dealing with hands-on for the last like 6 years at the time and having to pay somebody to explain something to me with a lot less experience. And I didn't like that.
It just sounds like to me, since you were a kid, just like on the go, on the move, onto the next thing, work here, work there, own that, own this, you know? And it's just, there's just so much events happening in your life. How did that affect your mental health?
Great question. I always like to say as well together and as good I can look right now in terms of what I'm doing and how much I'm accomplishing. That wasn't always the case. At about 23 or 24, I was extremely depressed. And I think it was kind of repercussions of not taking care of the mental health. So when I was 23, I started ideating suicide. About 24, I actually tried committing suicide. Oh, wow. And with that, it was very weird because now speaking on it now, when you start ideating suicide, you kind of make sure that you alienate yourself from people around you that really care. And you kind of go into the space where you're a burden and everybody doesn't care about you and they don't check in. And you know what? Why would I even have them in my life? Mm. And that was kind of legitimately the textbook progression to what I did. I stopped talking to my friends. I stopped reaching out. And it got to a point where one day I was like, yeah, this is just it. Tried committing suicide. At the time, Four Corners actually came in while I was trying to commit suicide and saved my life. So hats off to him.
Shout out to Kirk, man. Wow. DDHD alumni too, man.
I am forever grateful because obviously I was going to do it and I wouldn't be here today.
Wow.
And if there's anything I always tell people is like, you got to know that there's light at the end of the tunnel, as like cliche as that sounds. And that tables always turn. Mm-hmm. It might be that you're feeling like this is it and I'm not accomplishing anything right now and I'm a failure. But you got to give yourself time. Give yourself that time to grow and to really get to the point of giving yourself the ability to become who you're going to become, which I obviously didn't. From that point on, obviously, started going into therapy and I preach therapy. Yeah. I think as people, if we go for doctor checkups, we should go for mental checkups.
100%.
And going through therapy at the time actually changed my life because number one, we all have traumas that we don't address properly. Yeah. And really addressing those traumas through therapy and being able to kind of, you know, get out of that idea that I'm a burden and get out of the idea that I'm a failure has changed my life. I mean, crazily, but definitely was a lot to handle. Yeah.
Well, we're glad you're still here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, if nobody told you back then, I wish they would have, that dreams don't have deadlines. So, you know, we keep going.
And that literally is it. Like dreams don't have deadlines. Yeah. Don't give yourself deadlines that you have to go by because that's only going to make it worse for you.
How, if you knew somebody else that was kind of going through maybe similar, or you saw signs that there may be similar issues with mental health, how would you talk to them or deal with that person?
I think what most people, and even for me, like a lot of my friends that I told you, they were angry at me. They were like, how dare you do this?
Right.
And I think that's a natural reaction because we obviously care about the people that are going through it and we want to like you know, scare them into not doing it. But the idea there, I think, is, and what this is what I needed the most, and this is kind of like what I tell people to that question, is just listen. A lot of the time, listening, not to respond, just listening to understand why somebody is going through something, can make a world of a difference.
That makes sense. It's I mean, it's very brave for you to talk about it that way. And then, you know, I can't praise you enough, because it's not an easy thing to say, to look at your, you know, to reflect on yourself and know that us as humans, we have faults. You know, we're not perfect. And mental health is a real issue. I preach therapy as well, so I'm so happy you talked about it. I think it's so important to have someone to talk to that's unbiased.
Correct.
That one outlet that you can go to, that you can reflect anything to them. It could be very dark thoughts. Sometimes I'll talk to my therapist. I'm like, yo, I don't know. My cat looks at me. I think he's going to kill me one day, bro. And then otherwise, it's like, yo, I think I'm down. You know, just talking to them about anything and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's a really important thing. And I think a lot of people think it's a weakness sometimes. Yeah. They think talking to someone is a sign of weakness, that they're not able to handle themselves. So it's amazing that, you know, you saw that, you reflected it, and you had help and support from Kirk to where you are today. And, you know, look how successful you are in terms of all the ventures that you've done. So what's next for you? You know, is your mission now to help artists into this Web3 world? Do you have other ventures that you're into?
No, I think between all the ventures I've ever been a part of, I think social impact has always been the number one priority. Mm. And that was actually recently enough, I started looking back and I'm like, what was the main thing? What was the main theme between all the different ventures that I've had? And social impact has been the main priority for me always. So with Muse, we want to make sure that, I always say that speed is not good for direction. So what I really want to do is do things slowly, but do it correctly. Okay. So where social impact is not a temporary fad, but it's something that actually sticks. So with Muse, the social impact aspect here is we want to build infrastructure in Canada to allow artists to stay, because we lose so much talent to the lack of infrastructure and the lack of ability of artists to make money and earn a living doing what it is that they like to do. And I obviously understand that this is not just me building a company, but this is me trying to change an industry that has severe, I mean, ground roots in like people and labels.
It's all messed up. You know?
Like, it is all messed up.
Yeah.
And that's going to take time. But I think it starts, and as corny as this sounds, it starts with the first person that really believes they can do it, and just making sure that there is a movement. And I'm sure that a lot of artists are fed up and a lot of artists need this. And whatever we can do from the tech side, whatever power we can put from the Web3 side into changing this industry, I think that that's what we're going to focus on for the next little while.
Why is pay equity such a big topic for you? Why is that very important to you? I mean, I could guess, but I'd love for you to explain it.
Growing up, chasing people for money was such an annoying thing to do.
Right.
And I'm a big believer that people deserve to get paid for what they do. Like this is why anytime that I hire anybody, I don't question their price, because this is a price that you came up with, and that should make sense to what it is. And if I can't afford you, it's unfortunate, but at least if I do, I pay you what you feel like you deserve.
Right.
So to me, I've been in the positions where people are like, yeah, but like I can get it for $100 instead of $500 as an example. And having to argue your worth to somebody has probably been the most annoying part of the journey for me throughout the years. So having to change that narrative now is almost personal. Like, I want to make sure that when artists say, you know what, this is what I deserve, that's what you get. And there will be people that won't pay that price, but there also will be people that 100% believe in you and support you and will. So
I like that.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about male-dominated industries as a whole? You know, in your experience, you seem like you're the outcast. You talked about how a lot of positions of power were to males. That's reality. How do women and anybody that's really not a man entering, that's, you know, not specific in any gender, how can they tackle that in the tech industry, which is a male-dominated industry, right?
Actually, every industry I've been in has been male-dominated. Yeah. Like every single one.
Very true.
So just so I understand the question, sorry, can you repeat that?
So how what kind of advice would you give to people trying to enter industries, but they're so scared of it because it's male dominated? They don't think they have a position of power that they can get into.
How do you maneuver?
Yeah.
Stay authentic to yourself. I think, personally, I've struggled with imposter syndrome pretty much my whole life. It's the thin line between being humble, but also just knowing your worth. So a lot of the time in being in male-dominated industry, I would question my abilities and question my accolades and question whether or not something is correct, only to find out long-term that I was right. And this is not to toot my own horn or anything like that, but mm-hmm. if you genuinely believe in what you've done and you have the experience and you have the knowledge and you think that something should be done in a certain way, really stick to that, because that speaks volumes long-term, like when you are in those rooms. And a lot of the time, you won't get the platform to do that, especially in male-dominated industries. But there's an ability, and I hate using the word prove yourself, but long-term, you, if you're knowledgeable and you know what you're talking about, it becomes undeniable at a point. Yeah. So that's how you rise up. That's how you make sure that, you know what, I know what I'm talking about. Doesn't matter if I'm a male or female, but especially if I'm a female in a male-dominated industry, like that's kind of the idea there.
Well, like it. On a side topic, in the entertainment industry, in your whole career, what are some crazy moments? What's a moment or an event that stands out that you're like, whoa, what the hell just happened here? Everybody seems to have stories in the entertainment industry.
So back in promoting days, and this is to speak on entrepreneurship a little bit.
Okay.
So we had competitors, obviously, and we were throwing an event on a night. And what our competitor did was bring a bigger act at the time, and they started making an event the next day with this bigger act.
Okay.
To compete,
yeah. 100%. Mm-hmm. And the event was way cheaper, and it was literally the next day, it was literally the same venue. Wow. And because of how much money was involved in production, and mind you, a lot of the artists that we had were just local artists. And it's really putting the power behind communities, because we ended up, I think it was the biggest event we've ever done, actually ended up being, and the other event flopped. And we had about, I believe at the time, it was something like 4,200 people at the government, just based on local talent.
Let's go.
And the ability for the teams that we had working for us to really, you know, come together and pull through with the people that, like, really supported them, to really support the artists that we were bringing on, and to show them that, like, yeah, you can be a big name, but you can also have the power of community behind you, where, like, people just genuinely believe in you.
Yeah.
True.
So that was a pretty crazy moment, and I felt very
victorious
at the end of it.
Showed you on the right path, yeah. And you worked with Logan Paul as well, didn't you? Mm-hmm.
I did. The previous project I was a part of was called Liquid Marketplace. We were doing fractionalization of high-valued assets. Mm-hmm. So essentially, people like myself who can't afford, you know, the Mona Lisas of the world, mm-hmm. We were fractionalizing them, putting them on the blockchain, and giving, allowing co-ownership of those items for general people. Mm. So the biggest one we listed on the platform was the $5 million Charizard 10, the world Guinness record trading card.
He's got the famous one around his neck.
Yep.
WWE moments. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was sold out. And that was in April last year when we launched. And after I assisted them with building the tech stack, prototype, assisted them with launch, that was kind of the end of that for me, just simply because I was always a music lover, less so than like trading cards and arts. So for me, it was more a learning process. It was dope to be a part of that team. I was dope to be a part of that whole journey.
Yeah.
But I kind of took the knowledge and decided that this is not exactly what I'm trying to do. So that's why Muse was created.
What was the reason for your passion for music? I never understood that.
There's a few reasons. Mostly because growing up, like, my parents were really big into dancing. So, like, every Sunday we would have, like, dancing. My parents would have dancing parties at the time I was a kid. But it was such a cute little moment that I would always kind of cherish. Wow. But also, beyond that, growing up and being alienated a lot, music was was just it.
It was just
like,
it
was just something. Yeah. It was like the voice inside of your head where you're like, I can always like turn to music. I can always search up dope songs that will reflect exactly how I feel mm-hmm. and make me feel better in those days. But also beyond that, I know I spoke on suicide, like those are the days that I needed music the most. Mm. So music has always had an interesting, I don't want to say soundtrack in my life, but sort of,
I like that.
Where it was always prevalent and it was always kind of the thing I would turn to. Mm. And that's why I always try to be around artists, try to help artists, try to like, you know, with doing the events, we would always bring in local talents mm-hmm. because of that, because of uplifting.
Yeah,
people that like kind of got me through the worst times.
Then we got one question here from Alicia.
Yes. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing with us. This has been incredible. My question actually, because you mentioned like music being like comfort and I resonate with that. I'm curious, what is a song that brings you comfort or a song that like brings you joy or makes you feel happy?
Oh man.
That's a great question. Alicia making me look like
okay.
questions here. God damn.
The song I always think about, and I don't even know why I like this song. I mean, it's great, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But don't the song that gives song. Me peace for some weird reason is I Know What You Want by Busta Rhymes and Mariah Carey. Hey.
Big tune. Big tune.
I don't know what it is. I don't know why. So it was actually super... It was an interesting feeling when they released the part two of that song.
Right.
That I was like, wow, this has been the soundtrack of my life for a very long time. And to see the part two come to fruition years later, it's been super dope.
That's amazing.
I mean, there's a whole list of songs that I can speak about, but that was the main one.
Well, I did not guess that. I wouldn't have guessed that in a million years if you even put a gun in my head.
I'm a big Busta Rhymes fan too, so I love it. I love it.
So I think we got room for one more question, which is our ending question that we always ask our guests.
Yes, yes. We are, like we said, the Dreams Don't Have Deadlines podcast, you know. And I mean, we're in service to help people's dreams become a reality. So we're so glad that you came by, you know, thank you for sharing everything with us. I learned a lot, but I know there's somebody out there who's in the midst of maybe giving up on their dream, you know, and we just want you to look into the camera and tell that person why dreams don't have deadlines.
Dreams don't have deadlines because tables always turn. If you look at a heart monitor, it's not a straight line because that would mean you're flatlined. It's always up and down. And you got to roll with the highs and you got to roll with the lows. So just keep going.
Damn, love it. Some bars, Greg.
Bam. Oh, bam.
All right.
She is
amazing.
A creative. Hello.
All right. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you over here. And thank you so much for sharing your story, sharing the journey of your companies. And we're definitely going to see you on Forbes list. So when you're on there, just remember us, little people. You know, you're probably going to sign our checks one day.
And we got to talk more Muse, yo. We got to.
We got to talk more Muse.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. We got to talk more Muse.
But where can people find you? How can people follow you and stay in tune with everything that you're doing?
I'm pretty much at Alien U at everything, all the different social medias. Alien, YEUX. I'm super open to hearing people's stories. I'm always here to help. I kind of preach that. I think part of something that people did a long time for me back in the day was they helped me and they told me to pay it forward. So I'm always here to help. I'm always here to guide and I'm always here to kind of be an ear if you need to, especially if you're going through something.
That's amazing. You heard it from her, Alien U, at all social channels.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you.
This has been a pleasure.
I'm your co-host, Marwan Menomini. This is the DDHP podcast and we got
Juice.
Thank you so much. Let's get it all wrapped. Work hard and I handle my business. Look up in the sky, whole squad, let's get it. No limit, no.